newcastlechurch.org. This is Christ the Center, episode 2 for February 1st, 2008, part 1 of a two-part discussion on building a theological library. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a panel discussion on issues in Reformed theology. Today on the panel we have Jim Cassidy again, whom we had last week, who's pastor at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Camden.
We also have Jeff Waddington again, so we've got our usual panel. It's becoming our usual panel. Jeff Waddington, who's also a pastor at the same church, Calvary OPC in Ringgoes. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Camden.
Yeah, I'm Camden Busey, as you've already picked up my first name. But today we're going to be speaking about building a theological library. So we're pretty excited to get into that and just talk about what types of books we should be getting, whether we're a layperson, a pastor, etc. And then even get into some practical tips on what to do once we have a gigantic pile of books. What to do that's not going to make our wives angry with piles of books lying around.
But hey, first, and I have a question that has nothing to do with the topic, I want to get it off my chest. If you are recording this program and your name is Camden, does that mean that you are a camcorder?
I guess so. Might as well. I've never heard a joke that on that slant.
That bad?
Normally, my joke, especially from people New Jersey, is of a different topic.
I thought
of
that one earlier this morning, and I just had to do it.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to add some sound effects for you. Maybe
maybe an audience in the background laughing.
Yeah, I can. I'll dig one of those up here in a second. But anyway, we got our first segment here is errata. Do we have anything to clear up from our last episode?
The question might be better put: do we have anything to keep from our last episode?
Maybe so.
I guess the only thing I would follow up would be is there were a lot of topics that we can spin off of that last conversation.
Sure.
And I'm sure we probably will in the weeks ahead.
There you go.
I'm sorry.
Do you want me to list some of those? I could mention them. Just off the top of my head, we did deal with the relationship of systematic theology to biblical theology.
Yes.
Okay. What about the relationship of the Westminster Standards to biblical interpretation?
Yeah, we reference the standards quite a bit without explaining.
How do standards affect our hermeneutic?
Jim, you want to?
That would be the big one, I guess, in our day and age, right? What does it mean to be confessional and biblical theology?
Yeah, that's a good point, and that will take up a show in and of itself, one that we should definitely set aside to discuss as we, I think, find our model in somebody like Gerhardus Voss, who worked self-consciously here at Princeton with a hermeneutic of a biblical theological hermeneutic, all within the framework of the Westminster Standards and the Reformed Confessions, not as it were tying him up or as it were imposing itself upon the biblical text, but that's now we're getting into something that is going to take up a whole show, but that's something that we should definitely look to flesh out some more in future shows.
Yeah, but generally we use it as
in the past, confessional Presbyterians and confessional Reform folk on the continent didn't see a problem with being both confessional and biblical. But that, again, as you say, that's a whole program
sure.
in itself.
Well, I'd just like to make the comment, because I know a lot of churches, there's my parents' church is just moving to the EPC, and they're moving from the PCUSA, obviously being dissatisfied with its theology, but they're becoming a confessional church. Now, historically, they haven't had any issues with the doctrine in the confession. However, the members are not very familiar with the confession, and they're not catechized, etc. And so maybe just for those types of people, the confession is not interpreting our Bible, so to speak, and we don't use that as our ultimate presupposition, our guiding principle, but it's general encapsulation of what we understand as the correct interpretation of the Bible. It's a distillation of our system of doctrine. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And we use it as guiding principles.
I don't have a problem with saying it. It actually guides me.
Well, no. We use them as, that's what I'm trying to get at. We use them as guiding principles.
Now, it may be that we'll just, you know, maybe I'm using a hypothetical here. It may be that we find that the confession or the catechism have a stance that we don't ultimately agree with. I don't have any exceptions to the standards, but I'm thinking, I suppose it's theoretically possible in your study of God's Word, you have the confession and the catechisms, and you're looking at a passage and you're saying, well, those don't jive. But as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing wrong with saying that the confession offers, it helps me with my hermeneutic.
Mm-hmm.
But none of us starts with a blank slate.
No, that's a myth.
I think that a helpful comment that was made, I think, by Wayne Keister, PCA minister out in, I guess it's North Dakota, Jeff?
One of the two Dakotas.
One of the Dakotas, yeah. When you get out that far, it all blends together for me. But on his...
Well, you know, that's the Midwest, isn't it?
Right, that's right. No,
that's further than the Midwest.
But he makes the remark that true creativity always happens within certain limits. Now, of course, if your exploration of biblical theology have led you to the conviction that the Westminster Standards are incorrect, then your conscience, I think, demands that you leave the current ecclesiastical or academic setting that you have found yourself in, where vows to the Westminster Standards are required, and just be honest and say, hey, look, you know, my exploration, my exegesis of the text says that I'm really an Arminian or an antinomian or a legalist or whatever the case may be.
Sure.
And I'm just going to leave and, you know, do my biblical theology in a context where I can be confessionally honest.
Now, is it possible before taking that step that a person could try to convince the church through the proper channel of a given exegesis?
Yes, yeah, of course.
But ultimately, if a person fails to convince the church, they ought to move on, basically.
That's correct. That is correct.
Unless the
confession is not beyond amendment. The confession is, even as per its own teaching, a fallible document which is submissive to the Scripture. So if the church finds that its explorations of the exegesis of the text of Scripture has pointed in a different direction on a particular point of doctrine, such as when the American church adopted the Westminster Standards, it did leave out certain sections of the original confession because of new understanding of the relationship between church and state, and they did not want to bring over whole cloth the old Westminster Standards, and so they amended it properly according to their own convictions, and that's something that's valid to do. However, if a person finds themselves out of accord with the rest of the church, and the rest of the church is committed to the standard of the doctrine that's contained in Westminster Confession, then a man ought to be honest and move on to another ecclesiastical context where he'd be honest about how he does his biblical
unless
theology.
It's rather somewhat minor in relation. There are people and pastors who have taken exception with the confession and stayed where they are, and the presbytery or governing body might allow for that in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess if we're talking about larger issues, then yeah, it is best to move on rather than violate your conscience or be.
You would be constantly in conflict, I would think.
Yeah.
And so you want to avoid that, I think. Besides, why would you want to stay in a denomination where you're? Now again, we're not talking about peripheral issues, but
no,
and central issues. Why would you want to stay in a denomination where you're in basic disagreement?
Well, that's maybe a question for another.
Yeah, hey, yeah. Hold that thought.
There
will
are
be
historical
right
reasons why churches have stayed in denominations that they disagreed. A lot of them surround around property rights, etc. But there are a host of other examples. But do we have any other comments, questions, errata, miscellany?
From the last episode, right?
In general, feedback yet. We haven't gotten. We've got a couple comments, but nothing needs to be addressed on air yet.
No, I don't. Other than to say that, of course, I think if the people who are listening that are interested in the topic discussed last week would be able to take a look at the resources that we placed on the website, mm-hmm. that would take them a long way towards coming into such a sound and thorough understanding of the issues that we were discussing that they would really do well to do that and would take them a long way upfield.
Good. Yeah, you can visit the site again at castlechurch.org. This particular show is at castlechurch.org/CTC. But under each episode, I try to put all our show notes in, a general outline, and then all the books that we've mentioned in a couple different forms. So you can either link to them through Amazon or download a bibliography. But basically what we're trying to do here is not only raise some issues, talk about the different topics in Reformed theology, but also to provide the listener, to provide you with a number of resources and a direction to go in. That's our whole goal. We're not just trying to sit here and pontificate. And if we do that, please email us and correct us, because what we want to do is be a help to the church. And that's why we're putting this program together.
Yeah, that's right. Just a question here that may not be appropriate to go over the air, as it were, but out of just mere curiosity, have you received any feedback by way of email, Camden, about last week's show?
Just feedback for the site in general. I mean, nothing major. We do have a phone number now. I don't know if I mentioned to you.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was one of my little surprises for today. But if you want to actually call in and leave a voicemail, you're not going to get a human being, but you'll get a machine that you can leave your vocal comments to if you'd like. And you can call 215-392-0946. Also, I've opened up the email address. You can actually get us at christthecenter@castlechurch.org. So either one of those methods,
very good.
The email good. Address.
And
the number.
The machine that you'll get, by the way, its name is Jeff Waddington. So he is a machine.
Oh, boy. Man. I don't know what to say.
No comeback, huh?
Nice.
Yeah, I don't know how to quite take that. On one hand, it could be a compliment, but on another, it could be a...
Oh, it was meant as a compliment.
Okay. All right.
So
anyway,
in
this particular episode, what do we call these podcasts, right? What's the proper term for one podcast?
You can call it an episode, but... We'd hope to get delivered, I kind of shy away towards the actual word podcast, not because I don't like it, but that's more of a delivery method.
Okay.
And so,
well, my point is that our subject for today mm-hmm. is building a library, so we really don't need a section on books, right?
Well,
the whole thing will be dealing with that.
That's true. But I mean, generally what he's speaking of is our picks of the week. If you have any books or any websites or anything you found this week that might be of help to somebody. Jim, you had mentioned to me a couple of weeks ago the B.B. Warfield and the Presbyterians OPC group on Yahoo Groups. It's an interesting place. I didn't know those two existed. So you want to get some...
I'm sorry, Camden. I couldn't hear you last point.
Well, we just mentioned the B.B. Warfield group on Yahoo Groups.
Yeah.
It's an interesting place to go, and they have fairly regular posts.
That's right, yeah.
Did anybody find anything online this week that might be worth passing on?
Well, in terms go ahead, Jim.
No, you go ahead.
I'm going to say, in terms of sites that I regularly visit,
mm-hmm.
There are a few. One would be Green Baggins, which we've already mentioned. That's run by our good friend, Reverend Lane Keister. He's amazing in keeping up with the latest trends within Reformed circles, theologically and biblically. Let's see, who else? Martin Downs over in the UK has a website called Against Heresies. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good website. Good website, yeah.
He's very perceptive. He's a pastor, I believe, in Wales. Very perceptive gentleman. There's the Heidel blog, which is done by Scott Clark, Westminster, California.
I might also add Rodden Gleason's website, too.
Ah, yes. Christianity and Doctrine. No.
Yep.
Let me check on that. I have that bookmarked.
Christianity, sure. Doctrine, and Ethics.
That's it. That's the one. And he always gives about a once a week blog. Martin Downs at Against Heresies can almost be daily, but not always. And then, of course, there is. Can you hold on, gentlemen? I've got a call. I've got a doorbell.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and fill in where Jeff left off. I would also recommend Building Old School Churches.
Yeah.
That's the website of Andy Webb. What's neat about this website, not particularly geared towards biblical theology, but it is some good pastoral advice from a number of resources. Andy has built quite a church. Actually, the Lord has built the church, but has used it in a very transient location next to a military base. And he started the church as a plant, church plant of the PCA, and has stayed faithful to the means of grace, a word, sacrament, and prayer. And the Lord has blessed that faithfulness and built up that church. I think that's a testimony to the Lord's means of grace and to be faithful to it. Anyway, it's a good site for some encouragement for pastors of small churches that are maybe, you know, committed to the doctrines of grace, committed to the means of grace, but might be tempted by some of the fads that are out there. It's a good word of encouragement.
Mm. Was that Andy Webb's website, Jim?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Building Old School Churches.
Yes.
That was the next one I was going to recommend.
Excellent.
There's also something called Castle Church Radio. We'll leave that alone.
Okay.
That was. You can laugh. That's okay.
All right. I wasn't sure.
And the other thing is all those particular websites will connect with other ones with particular conversations.
Yeah, that'll get you into the network. Yeah,
you can jump all over the place, follow
right.
The leads as you see fit.
Yeah.
This all kind of leads in because you can get some very good information there and find out about current topics and interesting news and things that pertain to the ministry. But I think it's good to emphasize that these should be secondary to a good library and a good reading plan.
Oh yeah, my own opinion on that topic, Camden, and I think we've talked about this in the past. The electronic media is useful in with regard to searching or researching, But there is something, I don't know how to describe it, tangible, more tangible in having a book in or an article in your hand.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that I can tell you right now what it is that's more tangible.
Well, it's certainly not as transient. You know, the web, the web is good, but, you know, you can find a piece of information on an article written by somebody, and the next day they can go and edit it, change it, and it always changes.
Yeah, there's something very permanent about actually publishing material through the traditional means and having it there. People, this isn't just a comment meant to cover a blanket statement, so to say, but people generally are going to put more effort into a book or something that's published traditionally because it's that for that very reason. You can't go back and fix it. It's out there. And so you're going to do a whole lot of legwork, a lot of stuff that, you know, with a blog post you might not do. And so there's a lot more thought, generally speaking, to a book or to a published article.
There are wonderful electronic resources out there, especially the and I forget the title of the company, but they make a number of electronic resources like the collected works of John Owen, where you can search it on your computer, you know, and they have this for a number of, you know, Calvin and Edwards and all the Puritans and all this. And those are good and wonderful resources to have for searching, et cetera. But I don't think it's old-fashioned to say there's nothing quite like having the text in hand where you can, you know, turn the page, you can write it in the margins, you can highlight as you need to, you can bring it with you when you're sitting at the doctor's office. You might look a little bit funny with your laptop at the doctor's office, you know, reading John Owen or something, but when you have a book in your hand, I don't think that will soon be replaced. I could be wrong, but I hope not.
Actually, interestingly, I just listened to the Albert Mohler radio program. If you go to almohler.com, you can subscribe to that. But back on the 7th of January, he had an episode entitled The Twilight of the Books? And it was a whole hour-long program dealing with that very topic about the disappearance of books. Also the importance of books and how it's important to read to our children, to get them into books, because there's a certain way in which we learn, and a book is an active way to learn, whereas
That's
television
right.
and not, I mean, you still read online, but a lot of what you find online is passive. And I got a great book on that subject by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And if you read that title, it really opens your eyes to see how our culture has changed after the introduction of television and what that's really done to us. And it's not just the content that's on the TV that he's getting at. It's the actual way the TV delivers material to you. It's because we get used to sitting and receiving and being passive, and our critical thinking becomes disengaged. We just receive it.
What I'm concerned about with Camden is that people, what the internet does do, I think, is facilitate atomism and proof texting.
It's very postmodern.
Sort of taking, you know, you look in there and you say, oh, you know, here's a quote, you know, and you got a sound bite and you pull it out of context. When you read a book, you have to read at length. You know, you cannot read John Owen's The Death of Death and the Death of Christ with at sound bites. It's not going to be any good. You got to read his entire argument as it flows in order to get a sense of what he is really saying. And quite frankly, who's got the eye stamina to sit in front of your computer and to read page after page after page of this argument?
Get a device like the Amazon Kindle, located on the right side of our webpage at castlechurch.org. Just click it and you can buy it and have an electronic device that will not strain your eyes. This advertisement has not...
Okay, do you have one, Camden, so you can verify that?
No, I've heard... hey, you're screwing up my
plug
here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, that's supposed... that's supposed to hold something like 10,000 books. Is that right?
I have heard a number of people talk about them, and this is a cool device.
My wife would love that because then we could do away with my library.
The only problem is I don't know if how much theological material is available for it, but it'll read PDFs and do all that kind of stuff. So if you happen to have,
you can see the benefit of something like that.
Oh
for
yeah,
right?
Well, and that relates to our subject today. I mean, the fact of building a library. We've already started talking about this, the importance of books in general. But just to go back to your comment about the atomizing of content, you're exactly right. I was reading, I think it was Team of Rivals, which is it was that plus Postman. Team of Rivals, a book about Abraham Lincoln. And it's just fascinating to see how the political debates used to be run back, like during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. They used to sit and people would come and sit for 3, 4, 5 hours and hear a debate and hear lengthy discussions where they would build a case and you would have to follow the thought. You'd have to follow the reasoning all the way through to see where they're coming from. What do we have nowadays? Nowadays, the debates are taken to YouTube and they're split up. So what you get from a candidate is a 30-second soundbite. And we don't know, we can't know where they're coming from there, but it's very postmodern. The way I say that is you can take your little bits, your little chunks from all over the web and arrange them the way you want and create your own narrative as a result. You're building your own line of thought rather than listening and interacting with somebody else's. And that's one problem. And that's not just the internet.
That is a danger also in print. So we want to be careful. That we don't suggest that can't happen in print.
No,
but the nature of the print media is that you generally have to jump through several hoops to get to the end, whereas the web allows you to self-publish, right?
Yeah, and self-organize and self-edit other people's
whereas
materials.
What I mean is, normally, if you're wanting to publish in a magazine or a journal, you have to go through an editorial process. Right.
That's why we've started doing what we write.
Go ahead.
That's to just make the comment that, you know, anything we write online, anything I write online, I don't have high hopes for or anything. But at the same time, we have people edit the material and look at it to make sure.
Right.
I'm not,
you should make that clear as you just did, Camden, that the web material that you're connected with has always been vetted.
Vetted, yeah. Reviewed, I mean, to make sure that,
right.
For a number of reasons, it's just good practice.
Well, yeah, it's Carl Truman, who's the on the staff and faculty of Westminster here in Philadelphia. Some time ago, one of the criticisms he offered of the web is that there is that tendency to bypass the peer review process.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas... The nice thing about the Castle Church and the Reformata is that has not happened. It is not happening. That's a plus, shameless plug.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's. I think it's a good practice, and I don't want to blow our own horn, but I think if the entire web did that and had reasoned people editing and reviewing before people post, I think we'd be a lot better off.
Well, you know what it is? It's the so-called democratization of knowledge.
And there are good things about that, too.
Yeah.
But
it's a mixed bag, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's where we're going to be careful, because the one side of the spectrum is that all user-generated content is fantastic. We need to go down that route. We need to publish everything. If you have the capability of making content, you should. And then we have the opposite side, which is saying anything that's not professionally done is ridiculous. It should never be put out there. The traditional means are the only way to go. And as many things, I think, find the middle ground there. But we need to do it wisely and not go one or the other directions without really thinking through. We need to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. Yeah.
So
in the end, what we're saying is that in terms of, it should not be paper or electronic,
no.
But a wise use of both.
Yeah, I think we need to look at the medium and understand how that affects the message, because it inevitably does. There's no way to change mediums without somehow changing the message. But we need to look at, I think, when we're publishing, if you wrote something for an article or for a journal and then you're considering putting online, you really need to step back for a minute, for a couple of days, and really think about what's going to be different about this, or how is the internet delivery going to change this? How is it going to be received different before you do it? And if the negative override the positive, you probably should rethink what you're doing. I'm just saying we need to be cognizant of the fact that the internet does affect not only how fast things get to people, but the way that they're received. We've been talking about general mindset. No, we've been talking about the medium, and the reason why is because we're talking about today the medium of books, and our topic is building a theological library, and we want to encourage people to have a general mindset, first and foremost, that books are more important than other things. Books are more important than your television. And if you're spending more time with your TV than books, especially as a minister, we need to talk about some other issues, because reading
that's a spiritual problem, my friend.
Yeah. But I mean, television in and of itself isn't bad, but television, as we said, there's not a whole lot of content that's worth watching. Television is a different medium, so you're receiving information differently and effectively, passively, effectively dumbing down your mind. You just are. So our general mindset needs to be that books need to take primacy, not over your family. Don't buy books at the expense of reading your scriptures. We're not talking about that, but just in general, we're talking broad strokes. Your library needs to be something that needs to be fairly important in your life.
Well, you know, Erasmus said, if you have money, buy books, and if you have some left over, buy some more books, and if you have some left over, maybe buy some food.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that your perspective, Jim?
Maybe not over the food.
I do try to feed my children first.
Yeah, and you got some other responsibilities.
I'll buy some books.
But generally, I mean, how do you guys go about? If somebody mentions a great book on a subject, what's your general practice in terms of remembering that? Or do you just say, oh, that's nice, and forget about it? Do you only buy books you're currently looking for or currently interested?
Well, I wouldn't know what I would do without Amazon.com's wish list.
There you go.
That's where I keep a good deal of my prospects.
That would be Amazon. Basically you can search the publishers, because most of the publishers have websites now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So basically, there are a few outlets. One would be, now, some of these remarks may be more appropriate for the minister as opposed to the layperson, although, in my opinion, there's no principial reason why the layperson can't follow this path. You can check websites, which I do regularly, just to see what the latest new releases are. You can do that with Amazon for a generic search. You can do that with publishers' websites. You can do it according to the websites that we've already mentioned, like Green Baggins, Heidelblog, Building Old School Churches. Whatever your favorite websites might be, if they are geared toward intelligent Christianity, there are going to be discussions about books. Then, of course, you can also depend upon word of mouth. You can depend upon reading of periodicals and, magazines. And if you're like me, or like all three of us, we're academics in some sense, we read theological journals where there are book reviews. Even a journal like Christianity Today or denominational publication like ours in the OPC, New Horizons, and The Ordained Servant, they all have book reviews.
And those are generally timely. They don't pull books off the shelf and review them. These are generally new publications within the last year or two.
Right. So, I mean, there are ways. Right. You don't want to be buying, or you can't be buying everything that's produced. Right?
Right.
So you're going to be selective, whether you want to be or not. So the thing to do is to determine your standard of selection.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
And basically, if you have people, you can do what I just said, you could also depend upon the opinions of trustworthy people.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to mention...
Which is really the same thing as reading a book review, right?
Yeah.
What that does is it helps you to...
it's a filter. It's a filter because
right.
You can't...
Another thing that's worth considering, and this is comes up in a book called How to Read a Book by Mortimer Adler and Charles Van Doren.
I put that in our
bibliography. Did you learn the art of skimming?
Yes.
You could, in a bookstore... you know, like Barnes and Nobles or Borders
or Westminster
Christian bookstore. Skim a book to see very quickly by actually reading the blurbs or the dust jacket to see if it's a book you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
There are clues to determining whether a book is written or published by a real authority on a subject.
And just a tip, I was talking to James Dalzell, who wasn't able to join us today, but another very slick little way to find if something's worth reading is especially if you're in a topic or doing research or you're diving deep, look at the bibliography of those books.
Exactly. That's the one thing I left off.
Yeah, I mean, if you're finding that such and such book is referenced in four or five other books that are important to you, you might want to pick that up because it's telling you that that's being interacted with. And if that's the case, right, it's probably worth reading.
I was just reading something. I can't remember now what it was. I hate that. Where the author says, if you want to know what books I think are important, Doug Moo's Commentary on Romans in the New International Commentary on the New Testament. He has a bibliography of, you know, a couple hundred books, and he says the books that I think are important that everyone ought to, you know, every preacher, minister ought to refer to are the ones where I say, see especially. So there are ways, and some of this just comes with practice.
Sure.
Right? I mean, you get used to some of it, you end up doing, and you don't realize you're doing it. Like the one being, well, if I have a good book on a particular topic, I look at the bibliography, and if I've read the book, I might see constant references to particular other articles or books. That's a good clue that those are things I might want to read.
Absolutely. And that even works not just at the scholarly level, but for the layperson as well.
Yeah, on a general day-to-day level for the layperson who wants to know what to read, right?
Yeah. That's good.
That's
practice.
Right. That's right. could we mention maybe some titles that are a must-have for a lay Christian? Somebody who just is wants to learn more about the Word of God, and he needs to know what should I definitely have on my shelf.
Yeah, I brought up Jeff. You want to march through some of the titles that you had mentioned? Jeff was published in Modern Reformation. Speaking
yeah, I published
about
an
this
article back in what year was it? 2003, I think. Somewhere around there. On building a library, and that was the goal of that article, was to go through by subject books that I thought would be a good basic library, even not only just for individuals, but for a church. If a church is looking to build a library. That's worth going through. Now, what I did when I wrote this is I labeled books as beginner, intermediate, or advanced.
Right.
Do you want me to just mention that as I go through these?
Yeah, briefly.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Clearly, and then the other thing I did is I went through the categories according to what at the seminary we call the theological encyclopedia. And all that means is I went from Bible to hermeneutics to systematic theology and apologetics, church history, and practical theology. It's topical, in other words. So starting with the Bible, and feel free to jump in if you've got other recommendations. in this category, of course, there's lots and lots of books.
Well, here, maybe I'll stop you for one second. We've also got another list that I found very useful. The Westminster Seminary has put together a recommended reading list for people going to seminary. So,
and that's available on their website, right?
Yeah, I'm going to put the link in the show notes, but maybe as you go through your topics, I'll throw Jim, you and I, maybe you'll pepper some of these in there.
Oh, it's right there. Yes,
yeah,
I see it.
I sent you the link. So we'll just go through the topics you have. And if you don't mention something that we think is worthwhile, we'll try to pass that on. But
yeah, the first book that I mentioned was Packer's. This is on the Bible now.
Yeah,
Packer's little book, God Has Spoken, which is a discussion of verbal inspiration for the interested layperson. And if you find that book helpful, then you might. And that's a beginner type level book. If you find that interesting, you could jump up to an advanced level with B.B. Warfield's book, The Inspiration and Authority of the Bible. These are all things, by the way, that I believe are still in print.
Yeah, those aren't going to be hard to find.
Okay, so those are dealing with not so much the... it's not a description of the books of the Bible, but it's dealing with the nature of what is the Bible is God's Word, you know, being divinely inspired. What does that mean? When we say the Bible is authoritative, what does that mean? Those are the kind of questions that those books are dealing with. In terms of what we call biblical theology, and I think this came up last week, Graham Goldsworthy has a book called According to Flam.
Right.
And I would say that is a beginner-level book. And that's, of course, that's actually how it's marketed. On the cover of that book, it says an introductory biblical theology. And again, that's dealing with the historical unfolding of God's revelation in history. A more intermediate level book would be Willem van Gemeren's book, The Progress of Redemption. And the more advanced book, of course, would be Gerhardus Voss's Biblical Theology. But they're all dealing with the same topic. There will, of course, be differences between those three writers. I don't want to suggest that they all hold the same detail. Okay, so
I would also throw in the four volumes set by de Graaft.
Promise
that's
right.
Fulfillment.
Correct. That was, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, that was written as a Sunday school series originally?
That is correct.
And it's used that way even now in many of our churches.
That's right.
A very good summary. The graph, of course, is more thorough, right, because it's four volumes.
Yeah, it covers the whole Bible.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of basic surveys, I mentioned William Hendrickson's Survey of the Bible. That's a good beginner survey. It covers the whole Bible, Old and New Testament. With regard to the Old Testament, I mentioned Dillard and Longman's An Intro to the Old Testament. It has problems, but it's one place you could start. With regard to the New Testament, there's the Machen's New Testament and Introduction. That's a good basic intro. And if you want to delve much deeper, there's Donald Guthrie's New Testament Introduction, which is for the advanced reader.
And Moo Carson and Morris's Introduction to the New Testament
right.
I found helpful, too.
That's that obviously I couldn't mention every title that I wanted to in this article and, you know, keep it within a certain amount of space. So the Moo Carson Morris is a very good volume. Jim, is there a volume you might recommend alongside of Dillard and Longman or in place of it?
Dillard and Longman, you could go back, if you can find it, E.J. Young's Introduction to the Old Testament, which is helpful. It dated now, but helpful. And in terms of something more up-to-date, Intro to the Old Testament, I don't know I'm not aware of anything more conservative than Longman and Dillard. Oh, but I just that's my go-to book, and the problems that it has, I think, are outweighed by the benefits of a very helpful bibliography and very helpful reference to other commentaries. It's broken down, organized neatly according to each book, so there are. I think the benefits of that volume outweigh the problems.
It's has this been updated? Something tells me that there's a newer edition, but I could be wrong on that.
I don't know. In terms of a New Testament theology, not an introduction to the New Testament, but a New Testament theology, a volume we should have mentioned last week was the new volume out by Thomas Schreiner.
It was actually not out yet, Jim.
I'm sorry?
It's not out yet. It's due out in May.
Okay, due to come out, that will be, I trust, a very helpful volume.
Yeah, I was going to say.
The Magnifying God in Christ.
He's got a very good book on the Apostle Paul, but that volume looks like, from the review, there are already reviews of it, believe it or not, and it hasn't hit the bookshelf yet. I'm sure those reviews are based upon advanced review copies, right? So, and even the negative reviews that I've read are by people in, say, the Wesleyan tradition. It makes me want to get the book.
You can actually, just to mention a little tip.
Bad man that I am.
Well, a little tip, when you pre-order stuff, I mean, I just totally sounded like a shill.
Well, that's, for me, that's a matter of whether I have the money.
Well, yeah, but
very simple.
If I want to be a shill here, if you pre-order stuff from Amazon, they give you another 5% off. Just as a tip.
That's a good idea.
But sometimes Amazon, a lot of times, they can't beat Westminster's price, which is WTSbooks.com. Great website, great bookstore. But Amazon's out there too. And if you buy stuff from them through our site, we get a little chunk of the change to pay for our bandwidth. So,
and that actually brings up a good point, Camden, that it's okay to buy from more than one place.
Oh, yeah. I mean...
Well, some people, you know, like they have brand loyalty. They have brand loyalty with regard to the store or where they get the item.
Yeah.
It's okay to order from the Westminster Bookstore and Amazon.
Yeah,
and
I do that. I split my purchases fundamentally on finances, based on what's going to be the best financially for me. But
that's right.
They're both great. I mean, if you're anti-capitalist, go with Westminster. But Amazon, you get your stuff pretty quick, and they've got good prices. But generally speaking, Westminster will be.
I would recommend as well to save a few bucks to also shop on the used book.
Oh yeah,
websites.
Well, I agree.
Yeah, even for ones that are – a lot of times we go to Abe Books or bookfinder.com looking for books that are out of print. But even ones that are in print, you can find them cheaper, used.
Absolutely.
As long as you're not sacrificing quality, you know. You could get a perfectly good, you know, a book that's been used but at half the price. So, you know, shop around.
Well, oftentimes you can find – here's an example. I wanted to get Ritter Boss's book on Paul. And I didn't want to pay the $25 or $30 that it is in paperback. I found a used copy that's nice, signature sewn, hardback, same exact text. And it was good. It's ex-library, but it's a good copy. And I got that for like $10. And, you know, it has some pencil marks in it, but I don't care. I'm going to mark it up anyway. And so there's an example of times where you should actually get used books that are actually better, meaning hardcover with signature sewn here, where I saved $20. You know, so those places you can go, they mentioned Abe. Also used.addall.com, which is kind of a meta search. It's actually a really cool site that James showed me, which it searches all of the big used bookstores. So if you go to used.addall.com, that'll actually search Amazon. It will search Abe. And so if you're looking for something in particular, you can even specify bindings. And you can dig up some really, really rare stuff. And the more scholarly you get, the more rare stuff you're going to be looking for. So
I mean, and this is where the web is particularly helpful, don't you think, Camden?
Yeah.
Is hunting down books.
I mean, finding this stuff before would be a matter of being buddies with a guy who trafficked in this stuff. And James, I wanted to get him on to talk a little about Credo Books, because there's a guy in Grand, I think it's Grand Rapids, who does traffic in this stuff. And if you really need to find something and you're not finding it yourself, do a search on Credo Books. They have a store at Abe. But I don't know the man, but James is telling me that this guy can dig stuff up for you. You just put a bug in his ear and he'll find it. And so
we all probably all three of us have those kind of gentlemen. We have the gentleman locally in our area who does that kind of work.
Yes.
David Lockman.
Okay.
It is his PhD at Westminster and his PhD at the University of St. Andrews, I think, over in Scotland. And he, you know, I asked him one time, how did he get into the business of antiquarian books? He also deals with modern books, too. But he basically got into the business because he wanted to build his own library. And the cheapest way to do it while over in Scotland was to go onto estates and buy whole libraries and keep what he wanted and sell off what he didn't.
Sometimes, or either that or you find seminaries that, for one reason or another, have closed shop, and so you can find entire libraries. And there are people like that do buy entire libraries, and they sell off the stuff that isn't going to make sense to keep, and they keep the good stuff. And so these guys are the kinds of guys you want to be friends with if you're trying to make a good library.
All right. Now, in terms of biblical interpretation, getting back to particular title, if you're wanting to deal with issues that you might deal with in interpreting God's word, there's D.A. Carson's exegetical fallacies. That's more for the seminarian or the minister, I think. Although I read it years ago as a minister, but hadn't yet gone to seminary. It's an intermediate level book.
Sure. And you can learn really useful phrases like illegitimate totality transfer.
Yeah, isn't that exciting?
You pull that out.
Of course,
that
isn't Carson's invention, the illegitimate totality transfer.
You'll learn about things like that. So next time when you're in a Bible study, somebody says, well, this passage means this. That's illegitimate totality transfer.
That comes from James Barr.
Yeah.
From the semantics of biblical language originally.
Yeah.
But it's now common parlance. Another volume is the Let the Reader Understand by Dan McCartney and Charles Clayton.
Good.
That's
introduction.
That's a P&R title. And another P&R title, which is more advanced, is our own professor, Vern Poitras.
McCartney's our own. What are you doing? Leaving McCartney out?
Said McCartney.
I know, but he's one of our own, too.
Oh, that's true. I'm sorry. Yes, that's right. But Vern Poitras and God-Centered Biblical Interpretation. So those two,
which I'm reading right now,
Let the Reader Understand and God-Centered Biblical Interpretation are a good. Of course, hermeneutics is its own burgeoning field, right? You know, since the postmodern era dawned upon us, hermeneutics is the big game in town. So there are many, many, many books on that subject.
This has been part one of our two-part discussion on building a theological library. We'll be back next time discussing church history, apologetics, and some other topics. But until then, visit castlechurch.org to read the show notes and download today's bibliography. You can also find more information about our other programs and even subscribe to our podcast feeds in order to get this program and others automatically downloaded to your computer or music player. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can send your questions or comments to christthecenter@castlechurch.org, or you can call us at 215-392-0946 to leave a voicemail. This is Camden Busey, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.